Oh, 9 o'clock on your Tuesday morning. Welcome in. It is the Extra Point. Tyler Head along with you here on your Tuesday on the game, flying solo this morning as Jack Veltri is out of town for the week. I was out, wasn't out of town, I was just off yesterday for Monday. Had a fun weekend going to the race at Atlanta Motor Speedway with my dad and my nephew. Took my nephew to his first ever race. Think he had a good time, and hopefully he'll want to go back for some more races in the future. Yesterday was a quote unquote day off for me, but as any adult will probably tell you, I spent yesterday mostly doing things that I haven't normally had time to do on days when I actually work. So going to the doctor, paying my car tax, you know, running errands, those kind of things. So that's how I spent my day off. But back in here on Tuesday, ready to roll for an abbreviated week. We are here only through tomorrow, and then stations off on Thursday and Friday for the 4th of July holiday. So getting in as much as we can here in the next 2 days before we get set for July 4th. And then, man, it really feels like once we get back from July 4th, we are fully off and running for the college football season as a Media Days is coming up a week from, or excuse me, 2 weeks from yesterday. We'll be down in Atlanta or over in Atlanta, hearing from all the coaches, hearing from all the players. I would imagine about this time next week we'll know who South Carolina's representatives for SEC Media Days are going to be. I imagine Lenore Sellers definitely going to be one of them, but the other two spots could definitely be an interesting debate, which we'll get into as we get closer to that announcement being made, again, probably coming up at the beginning of next week. But given the fact that it is July the 1st, very, very busy day, very, very important day across the sports landscape, and I can confidently say that a month from now, in the month of August, we will be playing football. So just think about it that way. Don't think about the days until kickoff, which right now is at 61. Think about the fact that next month in August, we will have college football making its return. You have week zero games coming up on August 23rd. Of course, the full slate of week one games on August 30th in South Carolina, wrapping up the month on August 31st with their first game against Virginia Tech. But if you want to make it sound even better, you do have football this month too. You have the Hall of Fame game coming up on July the 31st between the Chargers and the Lions. So we are finally in a month where there will be some form of football game being played between the NFL and college football. And once we get there, we are truly off and running through basically the middle of February now, which is when the Super Bowl wraps things up. So it's almost here, getting a little bit closer. I can almost taste it. So excited for all that, but plenty to get into for this morning and the day that is July 1st, right after, of course, our Sandstorm pick-me-up.
Time to get hyped.
Here's your 9 a.m. Sandstorm.
Sponsored by George Sink Injury Lawyers. Just call all nines.
It is time for your 9 a.m. Sandstorm pick-me-up, brought to you by South Carolina's largest injury law firm, George Sink Injury Lawyers. If you've been hurt in the car or at work, call George Sink now at 803-ALL-9. Today being July 1st is the cause for celebration for many, many reasons, and perhaps no bigger celebration being done than in the Bonilla household, as it is indeed Bobby Bonilla Day.
Become a very popular day.
So what's your day like on July 1st?
My text messages blow up.
Bigger than your birthday.
Oh, way bigger than my birthday. It's way bigger. And it's a fun day, you know, because it always brings a smile to my face that, you know, I was happy I put the money away. I didn't say, you know what? I want this now. I don't care what you say. No. Go ahead, put it away. I don't care when you give it to me. Just as long as it comes. And that was really the mindset is,
as long as it comes.
As long as if something happened to me, my kids would get it. So as long as that was fine, you know, okay, so be it. Something that I was worried about.
So today, as been the case every July 1st since 2011, will continue to be the case through 2035. Bobby Bonilla will get a check, or I guess a direct deposit, because that's how things work in today's world, of $1.1 $1,193,248.20 from the New York Mets for his deferred contract going all the way back to the year 2000. But it doesn't stop there. This is a little bit of a lesser known fact in all this. He also gets $500,000 each year from the Baltimore Orioles as a part of that deferred contract that lasts through 2028. So he's got a lump. He's got a nice hefty sum of about $1.5 million hitting his bank account each and every July 1st. And if I was Bobby Bonilla and knew that that check was coming every single year, I would certainly be looking forward to that. Looking forward to that too. So happy Bobby Bonilla Day! And again, he's still got another decade to go before those checks stop being cut to him and his family, obviously. Today is also a very significant day and, quite frankly, the history of sports in general and the history of college sports, as we are officially in the revenue-sharing era. It was right out a month ago that the judge, Claudia Watkins, I believe was her name, officially passed the revenue-sharing when it came to the House settlement that now enables student-athletes to be paid directly by their universities. Of course, we talked a lot about that $20.5 million that will be divvied up between the respective teams at most power institutions in college sports. Roughly football is going to get around 70-75% of most of that, and then it's kind of divvied up depending on what sports you value the most. With how the money's split up there, but we are truly in a new era of college sports. And if you haven't been able to say it already, which I really think we have, but I guess we can officially declare that amateurism is dead. Any shred of amateurism, for the most part, is completely gone, and now it is truly the athletes getting paid by the universities, and we'll see what becomes of this, right? Because today being the beginning of revenue sharing is also the 4-year anniversary of when NIL went live. It was July 1st, 2021, where the NIL era officially kicked off. And, you know, in the beginning, and I think back to this often, in the beginning of the NIL era, everything seemed, for the most part, pretty tame. I remember through that 2021 season, and after that, you know, you had a couple athletes that popped up with like brand deals and local endorsements and all those kind of things, which once again, fell in line with what the original intentions of NIL is going to be. Like, hey, if you want the quarterback of your school to do a commercial for the local chicken restaurant down the street, they can do that. They can make money off of it by using their name, image, and likeness. And again, in the very, very beginning, it seemed like that all kind of fell within that window. Well, then everybody kind of figured out, like, hey, if we, through these collectives, just pay athletes to come to our schools and essentially turn it into pay for play, we can make things work that way. And that's obviously what it devolved into and became this wild, wild west, as we like to talk about, when it comes to college sports. And we've positioned this many times, that the revenue sharing era doesn't truly fix everything. I think it's going to be interesting to see if there are any positives to take away from it as time goes along. But again, today being day number one, and even through the first upcoming season, which begins here in just a couple months, I don't think we can truly understand the scope of what the revenue sharing era is truly going to be. I really think until probably a year or so from now, when everybody's had time to work with it, when everybody's had time to, quite frankly, manipulate it too. Because that's the thing. Everybody's going to find a gray area, because that's what you did with NIL, right? Where, again, in the beginning, it was, you know, again, the true-hearted nature of endorsements and local brand deals and those kind of things, that everybody eventually said, hey, wait a minute, there's a loophole here that we can exploit and benefit our respective sports teams, whatever they may be, by just paying players directly. So there's going to be that kind of thing with revenue sharing. And I talk about the unintended consequences of rule changes in general a lot. And that's going to happen here. What that looks like, I don't know. We can try and project, we can guess, but there's probably something outside of our realm of thinking as of right now that schools and teams are going to start doing in the next couple years that we think, man, never really thought of that. Now, that could be for a good reason or that could be for a bad reason. We're just going to have to wait and see. But I still see this. I know I shouldn't read Facebook comments and all those kind of things, but I still see the idea thrown out there. Well, these kids don't need to make anything. We need to get rid of NIL. We need to get rid of revenue sharing. Like, it's not going anywhere. Again, going back to this Supreme Court decision many years ago that what the NCAA had been doing for over 100 years was illegal. Like, this isn't going anywhere. Like, players are going to be able to benefit off their name, image, and likeness and now get paid directly by their schools forever going forward. And that is never, ever going to change. We can only hope that it can be adapted to a more sensible model that doesn't, you know, again, kind of fall into disarray in this wild, wild west like NIL certainly had these past couple of years. So we'll see. Again, it's day number one. We're not going to learn anything as of yet, really until the games start being played. And even then, I think it's going to take some time to truly understand what this era is and what the loopholes that these respective universities are going to, and conferences, quite frankly, are going to be able to to figure out as time goes along. Today being July 1st also kind of kicks off the new calendar for the respective sports year when you talk about college sports, now that all of the baseball and softball and all those national championships have come to an end. So now we truly look ahead to what 2025 and 2026 are going to look like when it comes to college sports. And we welcome in two new members to the FBS, by the way, in Delaware and Missouri State. Both those schools coming up from the FCS level to join Conference USA. That means we are now at 136 FBS teams across all of college football. It's only going to continue to grow. I think back, and this goes back to my time of playing the old NCAA video games in the mid to late 2000s, 06, 07, 08, around there. And those games did feature a lot of FCS teams at that point in time. And that's where my, knowledge of those teams really kind of began within my early days of watching college football. But I remember even back then, there were maybe 104, 105, 106 maybe total teams when it came to FBS. But as time goes along, so many of those teams have now jumped up into the FBS ranks from FCS, bringing us to this crazy high number of 136. And again, they do it because of money, right? Like, if you can get into an FBS conference, even a low end one like Conference USA or the Sun Belt, you're making so much more. Yeah, you're not going to be able to compete for national championships, more likely than not, like you might be doing at the FCS level, but the money and the benefit of your university for being a part of one of these conferences with their TV deals and all those kind of things pays a huge dividend. Now, the question always becomes, hey, is North Dakota State ever going to join FBS? I don't know. Again, they are having a great time throttling the competition more often than not down there in FCS and winning national championships, but financially, it would be better for them, I assume, to move up to FBS, but I don't know if that'll ever happen because, again, they are the true dynasty of FCS football and have been for a very, very long time. Speaking of dynasties, Alabama was, of course, or has been the dynasty of college football for the past decade and a half, but we don't really know if that's continuing with Kalen DeBoer or not. Alabama is going to be coming into Williams-Rice Stadium coming up in October, and I think South Carolina has a distinct advantage in this game. I'll tell you what that is coming up next as the extra point rolls along. Tyler Head along with you on your Tuesday here on The Game. Welcome back in. It is the extra point. Tyler Head along with you flying solo on your Tuesday here on The Game. Counting down till Carolina gets the season rolling in just 61 days. And much like every single year, South Carolina yet again has another very difficult schedule. This one not as high on the strength of schedule as compared to past years. 13th overall, according to FPI, as far as entering the season. Now, that can obviously change as the season goes along as we learn more about these teams. But as of right now, South Carolina with the 13th toughest schedule going into the 2025 season. And that schedule featuring a lot of huge matchups. Of course, teams like LSU, Ole Miss, of course, the game against Clemson at the end of the year is obviously going to be a big deal. And anytime Alabama comes to town, that is always going to be something that gets a lot of people's attention. They'll be doing that on October the 25th. That'll be the homecoming game. Obviously, Carolina looking to avenge a narrow, narrow loss in Tuscaloosa a year ago, one that I really think opened the eyes of a lot of people, especially here locally, that, hey, wait a minute, this team can compete, right? And they'd come close against LSU and lost that game, obviously, but I think going on the road to Tuscaloosa really proved to a lot of people, like, wait a minute, they've got the skill, they've got the firepower to compete with some of the best in college football, and I believe that was the game that Mazio Bennett said afterwards, like, hey, we're sick of losing these games. We need to start winning these games. And obviously when they started playing more of the ranked teams down the stretch, like A&M and Missouri and obviously Clemson, they would win those games to close out a very strong final six games for South Carolina in 2025. But nevertheless, Alabama is making the return trip here coming up in October. And I don't want to sound like Thomas Castellanos in saying this, but they are not quite as scary when Nick Saban's not perusing the sidelines anymore. And I don't think you're wrong for thinking that to a degree. Again, that doesn't mean they're still not very, very good, like I think Castellanos was trying to say a couple weeks ago. But when you compare, you know, Nick Saban and all the cachet that he brings and what he accomplished in college football, yeah, you're going to be a little less scared when that guy is no longer on the sidelines. That being said, Kalen DeBoer obviously speaks for himself when it comes to his reputation of being able to win everywhere he's gone. Let's not forget that Washington team that he took to the national championship game a couple years ago, from a talent standpoint, was nowhere in the stratosphere of what that Michigan team was. So he overachieved with maybe lesser amount of talent in his time at Washington. Same can be said for when he was at Fresno State. Obviously, his time at Indiana when he's the offensive coordinator there. Like, the dude wins wherever he goes, but he's not undefeated. And when he does lose, that tends to be on the road. And that's where I think South Carolina may potentially have the advantage here. When you look at the 12 true losses in Kalen DeBoer's time as an FBS head coach, he also, the 13th loss would be that national championship game against Michigan, but I'll just keep this tied to the regular season here. In 9 of those 12 losses that don't count the national championship game, in 9 of those 12 losses have come in true road settings, including all 3 of his losses a season ago against Vanderbilt, against Tennessee, and late in the season against Oklahoma. I don't know what that correlation is. I don't know why Kalen DeBoer struggles away from his home venue, but there seems to be something there. And again, that potentially plays into South Carolina's hand as an advantage by this game being in Williams-Brice Stadium. Again, we have that window when it comes to where this kickoff will be. I really hope it's a nighttime kick because you get Williams-Brice Stadium at its absolute best, you know, full throat, full juice, all that kind of stuff. And if that is the case, then that could play even more into the advantage of South Carolina coming up on October the 25th. That'll also be the 4th time that Alabama's gone on the road this season. So they'll be week number 1 at Florida State, week number 5 at Georgia. They'll take on Missouri as well 2 weeks before taking on South Carolina. So we'll get a really good sample of Alabama on the road by the time they come to Williams-Brice Stadium coming up in late October. And again, I think they should be able to handle Florida State. But if they go out there and lose to Georgia and Missouri on the road, then you're feeling pretty darn good when those cats are rolling in here to Columbia coming up the end of October. Because, again, and I don't know why that is, but for some reason, Kalen DeBoer is not as good away from home. And look, playing on the road in general is very, very tough. But for some reason, when he does lose, it always seems to come on the road, at least for his time, you know, when he's been at the FBS level between Fresno State, Washington, and now Alabama as a head coach. And again, hopefully that plays to South Carolina's advantage. It also helps Carolina, I think, as well, that you're getting Alabama coming off of a big rivalry game. 3rd Saturday in October, the week before that, is the game against Tennessee. A revenge game for them as they once again got beat in Neyland Stadium last year. They get them at home this year in Brighton Denny Stadium. High emotion, high stakes game, obviously, that could have a profound effect on the top of the pecking order in the SEC at that point in time. We'll see how good Tennessee is, obviously, with the Nico Imaliava situation that happened earlier on in the spring. But you're getting them off the heels of a tough, emotional game against a bitter, bitter rival. Again, advantage possibly South Carolina. And this month of October, as it seems to be every single year for South Carolina, just kind of ends up being that swing portion of the schedule where your success or failure truly hinges off what you're going to be able to do in that month. And I'll loop this into the Ole Miss game as well because it's on November 1st, but it's within that four-game block in the middle of the season because you have two byes this year. So Carolina will play five games start the year, have a bye, play four games in the middle, and then have another bye, and then play three games to wrap up the season coming up in November. So those middle four games, basically the October slate, and then Ole Miss coming up on November 1st, that's your swing of the season. What you do in those four games determines how good or how bad you're going to be. Because let's be honest, there's a pathway where South Carolina could lose all four of those games. There's a pathway for South Carolina could maybe win all four of those games. That's very difficult. I don't think anybody's going undefeated in the SEC, and I don't think South Carolina is going to be able to get through that slate completely clean. But you could be 2-2. Heck, maybe you could be 3-1. But you have to be at least 500 through that stretch of games to keep any hope of the college football playoff or anything like that alive, certainly. You're standing in the SEC, all those kind of things. Because, again, I look at the first five games, and I could see a path for South Carolina getting to 5-0. At worst, I feel like 4-1. So again, as we learned last year, you need to be at least 10-2 to make the playoff. Like 9-3, depending on the circumstances, maybe. But I don't feel comfortable with that. You got to get to at least 10 wins if you were going to make the college football playoff. So again, if you go through the first five games undefeated, you have seven or more games. You can only afford two losses, more likely than not. And again, it feels like that gauntlet of the middle of October or the month of October is potentially where things could slip. Again, the Beamer teams, for whatever reason, don't play their best football in October and play their best, play their best games in November, close out the season. And again, if you're looking for any kind of advantage, I think playing Alabama at home is something that play in your favor, and hopefully it does help South Carolina out. Could potentially get them one of what's hopefully a couple of victories in that month of October that springboards them into a very, very important month of November with the challenging road test against Texas A&M, Coastal Carolina, in your penultimate weekend of the regular season. And then once again, what should be, if Carolina is good, one of potentially the best, if not the biggest matchups in the history of the South Carolina-Clemson rivalry. Last year's stakes were insanely high. This year's stakes could potentially be even higher if South Carolina can live up to the billing of how good we think they might possibly be. But again, that Alabama game, again, that hinge point of the season in October, I think South Carolina has a pretty distinct advantage with that game being played here in Columbia, given how much Kalen DeBoer has struggled on the road in his career as a head coach at the FBS level. We'll switch over to the NFL coming up next. Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk put out his list of hot seat candidates and maybe a little bit of a surprise at number one. We'll discuss that coming up next as the Extra Point rolls along. Tyler Head along with you on your Tuesday here on the game. Welcome back in. It is the Extra Point. Tyler Head along with you here on your Tuesday on the game. We'll get to Mike Florio's hot seats in the NFL here in just a moment. But as you may have heard on some of the little commercial breaks there, as well as what they talked about on the morning show, today, we are going to be shifting the lineup around here on 107.5 The Game, starting on Monday. Now, 9 to noon is actually the one thing that's not really going to change, so you're still going to have me and Jack from 9 to 10 every single day. Depending on the day, either me or one of my guests in Jalen or Sam or the Gamecock Club Hour, presented by Krantz Cooling Heating on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 to 11. And then from 11 to 12, it'll still be myself, Wes, and Chris for the Gamecock Central Takeover Hour presented by Firehouse Subs. Once we get to 12, though, it will no longer be me and Terry for the halftime show. It will be me and Bill Gunter. So Bill, after 9 long years on the early game. Going to be moving up to the 12-3 slots. Looking forward to working with him. Terry will move back to working with Jay. They'll be on from 3 until 6 with the postgame show, and Elijah will jump into the morning show with Preston Thorne. It's funny, you know, like Preston's already a morning person. Elijah, I feel like, doesn't actually sleep. If you've ever been around Elijah, he consumes enough caffeine daily to probably kill multiple horses, right? Like he always has a Red Bull, a Monster, or some form of large coffee in his hand at all times. So I don't have any doubt that he's going to have no problem at all waking up that early and doing the morning show with Preston. So looking forward to listening to those guys. And again, looking forward to getting to work with Bill on the halftime show starting next week. It's funny, you may not remember this because it was very, very brief before I started doing 9-3 every single day. I was actually Bill's co-host for like 2 weeks, going back to early 2023. And then we had some people leave. Lineup got shifted around very quickly, and I've been from 9-3 ever since. But I did briefly work with Bill Gunter going back to a little over, right now, about 2.5 years ago. I'm just looking forward to really working with him on a full-time basis and kind of reimagining the halftime show a little bit. So looking forward to that. Again, all that starting coming up on Monday. As we creep closer to the start of football season, again, the NFL Hall of Fame game coming up on July the 31st between the Chargers and the Lions. We talk a lot about hot seats in college football. What about hot seats in the NFL? Mike Florio of Pro Football Focus put out his top 5 candidates when it comes to the hot seat for the NFL in 2025, and kind of go from 5-1 here. Starting off just up the road, Carolina Panthers, Dave Canales entering what is year number 3 as the head coach of the Panthers. And again, they have not accomplished a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. Again, he's a first time ever head coach. He's entering year number 2 as the head coach at Carolina. First time ever head coach. 5-12 a season ago. Did win 2 out of the last 3 games. Bryce Young looked better when he came back from being benched, which that, you know, was a difficult decision to make, because when you draft someone number 1 overall, they are supposed to be the future of your franchise, and choosing to bench them just over a year into their career is obviously tough. But you definitely saw improvements. And that's why Dave Canales was brought in to Carolina, was to get the most out of Bryce Young. That, you know, ownership, Dave Tepper, didn't feel like Frank Wright was doing the season prior. So you saw improvements from Bryce Young when he came back from being benched after Andy Dalton took over. And you feel like they did end the year with a little bit of momentum. The one thing that could derail this, though, is, again, I mentioned David Tepper, that owner, who is erratic in a lot of ways, whether it be throwing drinks at people, confronting people in restaurants on draft day because they had a sign that was poking fun at him out front. Like, you never know what he's going to do, right? Firing Frank Wright before a full year was done 2 seasons ago. So, again, I am not in the business of wanting to fire coaches after 2 years, especially for somebody that's never been head coach before. But with David Tepper, you really don't know. So I think the job that Dave Canales has done up to this point doesn't necessarily warrant being on the hot seat going into the season. The unknown nature of the person that controls all of it and will do whatever he darn well pleases in David Tepper always means, if you're the Carolina Panthers head coach while he owns the team, you're always going to have to be looking over his shoulder at some point, and Dave Canales is no different in that regard. Number 4 is Brian Schottenheimer. Did you forget he was the head coach of the Cowboys? That's okay, because I have to remind myself every couple weeks that that's the case as well. That was so weird, right? When you fire Mike McCarthy, which we all feel like probably could have been done a couple seasons ago, it seemed like Kellen Moore was the guy for his prior time there as both a player and an offensive coordinator, but ends up going to New Orleans. They end up with Brian Schottenheimer, and it's one of those things, too, that, like, Jerry Jones likes to make big splash hires. He likes to make big deals about who he brings in, whether it be former people involved as players or guys like Mike McCarthy, who had won a Super Bowl previously with the Green Bay Packers. So when you get Schottenheimer, again, a guy that's been around the league forever, that nobody was clamoring for to be their head coach, it's kind of weird, right? Like, it didn't make sense for a Cowboys type of hire. And, like, nobody's looked at him as, like, this greatest offensive coordinator of all time kind of thing. We're like, oh, man, I can't wait to see him get his hands on a team as a whole. And, again, he's got the family tie of being Marty Schottenheimer's son. So that goes to a degree, but it's not the end-all be-all. And it just seemed like a weird, underwhelming hire for the Cowboys. That being said, could that mean he's on a short leash? I know he signed him to a 4-year deal, but if Jerry Jones isn't pleased in year number one, could he move on from him? I guess theoretically. Now, Jerry Jones, to my knowledge, has never fired a coach in their first year with the Cowboys since he has taken over as owner, so it would be an unprecedented thing to happen. But at the same time, it seemed like the hire was unprecedented too. So I guess nothing's truly off the table when you talk about Brian Schottenheimer and where the Cowboys are at as of right now. Because, again, I don't think Schottenheimer is going to suddenly turn him into a winner. I could be wrong, but it just doesn't seem like that's the move to really get the Cowboys going in a new and better direction. Number three, Shane Steichen at Indianapolis. He is dead even. 500 record. 17-17 through two seasons with the Indianapolis Colts after he was brought in, of course, after they fired Frank Wright back in 2022. And this really boils down to Anthony Richardson, AR-15. The jury's still out, right? For one, he's been injured. But two, when he's been on the field, it's been erratic play. It does not seem like he has rounded into his own as of yet. Now, you have to bring in Daniel Jones to compete with him and potentially push him to be better. I don't know about that. It seems like things are not looking the brightest for the Colts as of right now. And I think the fact that you play in a division with the Houston Texans, I think makes this look all that worse. Because DeMeco Ryans come in and hit the ground running, took his team to the playoffs in back-to-back years, and they are looked at as one of the promising young and up-and-coming teams in all of the NFL. Indianapolis isn't that. I think that creates more pressure on Shane Steichen as their head coach. And, yeah, especially if you come to the end of year number three, especially now that Jim Irsay has passed on and it's new people calling the shots in the Irsay family, there's no telling what they want to do. There's no telling what their connection, what their personal connection with Shane Steichen is. So very real possibility, if Indianapolis once again is at or below 500, they could potentially be looking at making a move, especially if Anthony Richardson is not showing leaps and bounds of improvement this upcoming year. Because you've been around the league long enough, you should be showing us something now if you're ever going to be something. There's two more names on this list, spots number two and spots number one for Mike Florio's hot seats in the NFL. I'll dive into those coming up next to wrap up the hour. It is the Extra Point. Tyra Head along with you on your Tuesday on the game. Welcome back in. It is the Extra Point. Tyra Head along with you here on your Tuesday on the game. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour for the Gamecock Club Hour presented by Krantz Cooling and Heating. Going to let you listen to some conversations we had earlier on in the spring with Josiah Thompson as well as JT Gear from Gamecock Football. So here's some thoughts from those guys as we, again, close in on the start of the 2025 college football season and football season as a whole in general, which brings us back to Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk and his top five candidates that are on the hot seat in the NFL in 2025. Of course, number five, as I mentioned a moment ago, Dave Canales with the Carolina Panthers. Number four, Brian Schottenheimer in his first year with the Dallas Cowboys. Number three, Shane Steichen going into his third year with the Indianapolis Colts. And that brings us up to number two on this list, that being Brian Daboll of the New York Giants as he enters a year that I think a lot of people are surprised he came back for. Year number four, after how bad the Giants were a season ago at 3-14, a very, very dismal season for the G-men up there. As again, kind of been the case the past couple of years, rotating through quarterbacks and all those kind of things. I think Brian Daboll is the perfect example of having success too quickly, right? He comes in there in 2022, winning record. They make the playoffs, winning a game against the Vikings for losing to the Eagles in the divisional round. And again, that was the best they'd done. That was the first playoff win they had had since they won the Super Bowl a decade prior. So he did something that hadn't been done in a while there, and the expectations suddenly became super high. And then you go and pay Daniel Jones all that money that he wasn't worth, and you're living the effects of that as of right now. So, again, quarterback situation, not necessarily great up there in New York between Russell Wilson and Jameis Winston and Jackson Dart. Okay, figure out, I guess Tommy DeVito's also there too. Figure out what you want to do with that. But it just seems like it's ticking, right? I don't see much of a chance, especially given the fact that two of the best teams in the NFL right now are in your division in the Eagles and the Commanders. You can almost count that to be three, if not four, losses already on your schedule, not to mention all the other games that you're going to have to play this season. So it just doesn't seem like, as talented of players they have at other spots like Malik Nabers, they just can't get the quarterback position right. And that's been their downfall for these past couple of years. And finally, number one on the list, maybe a surprise to some, Mike McDaniel of the Miami Dolphins, as he gets set to enter his fourth year as their head coach. And it's been solid. He's been 28-23. They've made the playoffs two times, but doesn't it kind of feel like they've hit their ceiling, right? Like let's go back to when Sean McVay was hired as the Rams head coach. Again, young head coach, and was like 35 or something whenever he got hired there, but was this like crazy creative offensive mind. They made one Super Bowl and lost to the New England Patriots and then ended up winning a couple years later against the Bengals. And you know, now, like, the Rams are good, but they've come back down to earth a little bit because the league has caught up to what Sean McVay was doing. Kind of feels the same way when it comes to Mike McDaniel. Again, when he gets hired as the Dolphins head coach, crazy offensive mind, doing all these wild things and all the motion and all the stuff that he does with his offense. And it's cool, and it was relatively successful, but it feels like they've kind of hit their ceiling with this. And a lot of that does have to do with the fact that Tua Tagovailoa keeps getting hurt, right? Like, the offense is very clearly designed around Tua, to the point where when he gets hurt, they struggle to score, like, 14 points. You know what I mean? So it seems that you can only go so far with that. And look, I hate to phrase it this way, it seems like Tua is probably going to get hurt again at some point this year. Especially with concussions, they add up, right? And the more you get, the easier it is to get more of them. And let's take a look at their quarterback room as of right now. So if Tua does go down this year, you have Zach Wilson, Brett Gabbert, and Quinn Ewers. Any of those guys feel like they can really step up and take the reins of this offense and be as good as Tua can be at his best? Absolutely not. And again, even with Tua out there, it feels like there's a ceiling to this. And not to mention the fact, when they do make the playoffs and inevitably have to go on the road, these guys can't win in cold weather. They haven't won a game under 40 degrees in years, especially since Mike McDaniel's been there. And let's think about some of the best teams in the NFL right now, specifically in the AFC. Kansas City, Buffalo, and Baltimore. Those places get cold in January and February? Absolutely they do. So you're almost setting yourself up for failure every single time because you can't seem to adapt to different elements. And again, I get it. They're down in South Florida. It's always hot down there. But there are teams from hotter climates that do just fine in the cold. And for whatever reason, whatever the preparation is that Mike McDaniel does during the week, can't get his team up to play cold weather games. And that, again, goes back to this, like, if there was a window for them to win a championship, it was very short and very quick. I think it's over now. Again, Tua keeps getting hurt. If they do make the playoffs, they can't win in these tough, cold environments. And you got skilled players there, obviously. But it just doesn't seem like you can take them seriously enough to put it all together. Again, will they probably win 9, maybe 10 games? Sure. But I don't look at them as a serious threat to do anything after the fact there. And I don't know how the Dolphins management looks at that. Again, it's surprising for a lot of people that Florio put him number one on this list. But if you feel like you can't get any further, then that's when you make changes. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but it's definitely an interesting thought, again, according to Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk. That'll do it for the Extra Point. Coming up next, Gamecock Club Hour presented by Krantz Cooling and Heating. You'll hear our conversations with Josiah Thompson as well as JT Gear of Gamecock Football up next here on The Game.